Ordinary television did not. It could interact with the viewer. You could tell it what you wanted, and it could go out and fetch it for you. You could chop through it. You could send instant messages through it and receive messages back. You could order up local news from anywhere in the world. You could order any movie you wanted, when you wanted it, and pause it when you went to the toilet. The machine could be the conduit for all information into and out of the home. The general idea hardly originated with Clark. Back in the late 1970s, the corporate ancestor of Time Warner, called Warner Amex, had created a pilot for an interactive television in Columbus, Ohio, called Cube. Cube was supposed to let cable TV viewers send messages to the networks and request the programs they wanted to see via remote control. But the machine didn't work particularly well, and it cost a fortune to build. The company spent $30 million trying to build it and then quit. Then there was an idea called Videotext, cooked up by researchers at the British Post Office, also in the 1970s. It hooked a black box between the telephone line and the television set and enabled people to send messages to each other while they watched the BBC. Nobody wanted that either. A few years later, AT&T and Knight Ridder came together to deliver the newspaper each morning to the masses on their television set. The masses yawned and went back to bed. In every case, at least a part of the problem was that the wires entering and exiting the average home were unable to transmit data with sufficient speed. The wires could handle printed text, which required much less bandwidth, but they could not send moving pictures. Moving pictures contained a lot of digital data, and so required vast computing power. Never mind. The engineering problem was so interesting that it seemed rude to spoil it by asking who exactly wanted to read text on his television. A stunning ignorance of mass tastes was a common problem in high technology. When a brilliant engineer dreamed up a product, he tended to build the sort of things only a brilliant engineer would appreciate. Typically, he overestimated the average person's willingness to learn how to use some new machine, and underestimated the cost of making the machine. When you page through the history of computing, you find a lot of very weird examples of just this. In a warehouse behind the Computer Museum, just north of San Jose, for instance, stands a gleaming red 4-foot-high computer built in the early 1960s. The kitchen computer, it was called. The organization man's housewife was meant to program her recipes into it. "If only she could cook as well as this can compute," read the ad in the Neiman Marcus catalog. The computer was premised on the dubious assumptions that every American housewife would, A, want a massive computer in her kitchen, and B, know how to program it. Neiman Marcus failed to sell a single unit. The idea Clark became wedded to, albeit briefly, was that the computer would become the most important household appliance. Information appliance was one term used to describe it back then. The company that built the first information appliance would sit in the middle of all human communication. It would be the McDonald's of information. It could play the same role on the television that Microsoft played on the PC. "The telecomputer was a direct result of the frustration I felt watching Silicon Graphics continually fall behind the PC in market share," Clark said. "I was trying to do an underbelly thing with Microsoft, come in under their monopoly and take it away." The telecomputer would be the most fabulous toll booth ever built, but before it happened, a question needed answering. Why would people rush out to buy a telecomputer? What would a telecomputer do that people simply could not live without? Clark had no great hope that Americans wanted their computers to educate themselves. He assumed they wanted their computers to play Nintendo and otherwise divert themselves from the poverty of their existences. The answer he finally came up with was, people wanted to watch any movies they pleased, whenever they pleased. The telecomputer would be many things, but at first blush, it would be a virtual VCR. Of course, Ed McCracken wanted nothing to do with a virtual VCR, at least at first. It was just another flaky idea from his flaky chairman, who refused to leave him to run the company alone. And so, Clark found another outlet for his ambition, the media. Once he'd recovered from his motorcycle accident, he shared his thoughts freely with journalists. "I might not have any power at Silicon Graphics," he says, "but they didn't know that. I was still called the chairman. And most journalists think a chairman of a big company is an important person." He knew perfectly well that McCracken disapproved of him talking to the press. But hype had its own wonderful generative power. The more he talked about his telecomputer, the more people wanted to hear about it. It was almost as if by talking about the telecomputer, he made it happen. "I would go out and I would just say all this shit to reporters," he recalls. "And they'd print it. And people inside SGI started to talk about it. And I thought, Fuck Ed McCracken. I can say whatever I want. And by God, if I go out and talk about it enough, Ed won't have any choice but to build it. Clark's opinions found their final published form in 1992 at the annual trade show for the computer graphics industry, called SIGGRAPH. Clark delivered as a speech the paper he'd written while he was laid up in bed, recovering from his motorcycle accident. The paper described the consumer's computer. Clark guessed it could be built in 2 to 3 years. He explained that while computer memory in 1992 made such a device too costly to be mass marketed, computer memory in 1995 would be a different story. He outlined the basic technologies: digital audio, digital video, transmission reception decoupling, resolution decoupling, all of which existed in one form or another. But he dealt with the technical side of things in only the sketchiest form. Mostly, his paper was a bit of political propaganda aimed at raising the heat on McCracken. In Silicon Valley, political propaganda took the form of futurology. "Over the next 4 to 5 years," Clark told his audience, "unprecedented change will occur in the computer, telecommunications, and television industries as multimedia technology enters the home via the telecomputer. The present local loop of the telephone system and the cable franchise for television will become one multimedia server loop. Each loop will represent tens of thousands of clients, each using a telecomputer. In the loop will be high-speed computer systems for serving audio and movies on demand, virtual reality games, digital forms of daily newspapers, weekly and monthly magazines, libraries, encyclopedias, and interactive books. In time, all media will be available in dynamic form." He was wrong about all of this, at least in his timing. He was often running down a dark tunnel that ran directly into a brick wall, but at least he was running. Clark's paper attracted a lot of attention from everywhere except Silicon Graphics' boardroom. The cardboard box in Clark's guest room contains a tall stack of fan mail and his responses. For instance, on August 4, 1992, he replied to a letter from Lance Glasser at the U.S. Department of Defense, who agreed with Clark and wanted to know why he didn't just build his new machine. "Silicon Graphics Management considers pursuit of digital TV a distraction," Clark wrote. "I am the driving force, but left to its own, SGI will not pursue this for at least 4 or 5 years. I believe the solution is to form a new company." By far the most important letter he had came from Jim Chittix. Chittix was the chief technology officer at Time Warner Cable. Chittix told Clark that he had heard his talk and that Time Warner shared his interest in the telecomputer. He agreed with Clark that now at last the world was ready for the new machine. Time Warner had just decided to yank out all of its copper cables and replace them with fiber optic cables, which transmitted data much more efficiently. In other words, the infrastructure would be laid for a telecomputer to traffic in moving images. More to the point, Time Warner was willing to pay someone to build a telecomputer. He suspected Clark was just the man for the job. The deeper Chittix dug into the problem, the more certain he became that Clark was the only man for the job, or at least the company Clark had founded was the only company for the job. In late 1992, Chittix toured the companies that might conceivably build the black box he needed. Microsoft, Oracle, Sun Microsystems, Silicon Graphics. They contained the biggest egos and brightest minds in technology. They sold themselves as hard as they could to Chittix, and yet Chittix came away with a very clear opinion. The engineers Jim Clark had brought together were in a class by themselves.
"It was clear that Clark himself had no power in the company," says Chittix, "but it was also clear that if anyone could build an interactive television, it was Silicon Graphics. Everyone at all these companies was smart, but the engineers at SGI, they were the real cowboys."
In October 1992, Clark finally made his pitch for his telecomputer to the Silicon Graphics Board of Directors. He opened with a slide that read, "How we can be to entertainment computing what Microsoft is to productivity computing." He laid out his view of the market, which he thought could be as big as $10 billion a year. He discussed potential competitors: Sun Microsystems, IBM, DEC. And then he pulled a kind of bait and switch. Rather than create the telecomputer inside SGI, he suggested SGI finance a new company to do it. In exchange for money and technical support, SGI would be granted a large equity stake in the new enterprise, which Clark would control. No more fucking Ed McCracken. Clark called his new company an entertainment computer company. As a kicker, he mentioned that Time Warner was willing to pay for the telecomputer to be built.
Not long after Clark's presentation to the SGI board, Pavan Nigam was called in to see Tom Jermalak, TJ as he was called. Improbably, TJ had been able to win Clark's friendship without alienating Ed McCracken. While McCracken was off playing corporate statesman, TJ ran the company, and it was through TJ that Clark exercised what influence he had on SGI.
"When I got the call that TJ wanted to meet with me, I thought he wanted to complain about the bugs in our software," says Pavan. "He was always complaining about our bugs, so I brought a list of the bugs and what we were going to do about them."
Instead, TJ had an offer for Pavan.
"How would you like to build the world's first interactive television set?" he asked.
He explained that Ed McCracken had come around to Jim Clark's way of thinking, but did not like the idea of Clark having his own company. Tom Warner was willing to pay SGI $30 million to build what it was calling an interactive television, ITV. Whatever SGI built would be installed in 4,000 homes that Tom Warner was wiring for the occasion in Orlando, Florida. And on the recommendation of Jim Clark, it wanted 29-year-old Pavan Nigam to run the project. The minute Tom Warner announced that it had chosen Silicon Graphics, just about every big company that had anything to do with information or entertainment leapt into action and hired its own engineers to build them a telecomputer.
"There was a mad scramble," recalls Chittix.
AT&T and Viacom announced that they were building their interactive TV pilot in Castro Valley, California. TCI and Microsoft announced their pilot in Seattle. The phone company, US West, the computer company, DEC, and the computer animation company, 3DO, announced their own project in Omaha, Nebraska. Oracle announced its vague intentions to get involved. When you added it all up, it involved thousands of people and hundreds of millions of dollars. The telecomputer was the first big step in a new direction. Very large companies and a lot of important investors became swept up in the idea of an intelligent home appliance. They bought into Clark's notion that people would shop, communicate, and amuse themselves through their televisions. It took about 3 days for Ed McCracken to make the telecomputer his own, and for the Orlando project to become the place to work at Silicon Graphics. Before long, Michael Douglas and Arnold Schwarzenegger had dropped into SGI's offices to hear about the technology that would change their business. The CEO of Time Warner, Gerald Levin, rolled up to the front door of Silicon Graphics in the longest limousine anyone had ever seen. The scramble to get assigned to the project became so vicious that McCracken sent out an email warning engineers about sabotaging each other's careers. At the same time, he let Pavan Nigam know that the project was critical to the future of the company.
"Spend what you need to spend. The thing must work," was what Ed said, recalls Pavan. "All of a sudden, everyone thought ITV was the future of the company. All of us thought it was going to be the next big thing."
Pavan believed that if 1,000 people don't build anything, if you need to build something really complicated, really fast, you hire 50 of the smartest people you can find.
That is exactly what he did. He started by hiring Kittu Kalari. The telecomputer had been entrusted to Clark's private software tutors. The main appeal to the engineers of the telecomputer was its complexity. This was in itself an ominous sign. It's a good rule of the technology business that the more intellectually appealing a machine, the less likely anyone will pay for it. It was not trivial to rig a system so that the fat guy in the sofa with the beer in his hand no longer needed to drive to Blockbuster to get the movie he wanted. Every fat guy required his own video stream, and a single video stream contained a huge quantity of data. The computer needed to process information more quickly than information had ever been processed.
"Well, the Orlando project turned out to be the most aggressive supercomputer project ever put together in the history of the world," says Jim Barton, one of the senior engineers on the job.
"As a pure engineering challenge," says Marco Framba, another engineer on the project, "it was more difficult than any I've ever heard of."
Jim Chittix at Time Warner said,
"It required more lines of computer code than was required to put a man on the moon."
Pavan and Kittu were told that they had 18 months to build the new machine. They said it would take them 24. It took them 23. On December 12, 1994, the press piled into Orlando for the demonstration. Other companies had spent more money and employed more engineers, but none of them got a system that worked. Time Warner's CEO, Gerald Levin, sat on the stage with Ed McCracken and a couple of other suits. Their presence was a kind of assurance that technology moved in a stable and predictable manner, the way the men in suits directed it to move.
"Never in the history of telecommunications," Levin said, "has a medium of such complexity been designed, developed, and given its debut in such a concentrated space of time."
Then he picked up the remote control and pressed a button, and
It worked.
Like a charm, says Pavin.
The engineers received standing ovations. Levin cut the tape and announced that Time Warner intended to spend $5 billion to deploy this fantastic new technology. All Americans would one day live even more of their lives than they currently did through their television sets. The new technology would change the way people shopped, voted, worked, and loved. Ed McCracken followed Gerald Levin on stage. Without once mentioning Jim Clark, he explained to the audience how his team at Silicon Graphics was now poised to control the future. From their seats in the crowd, Pavan Nigam and Kittu Kalari looked up and knew it wasn't true. They had spent the last 18 months pulling off one of the great engineering feats of the century, and they had nothing to show for it but a black box that cost $5 grand apiece. Few would pay that much for the technology, and the value of the technology depended in part on a lot of people owning it. A VCR was as valuable if one person owned it as if 100 million did, but a television that interacted with other televisions demanded an audience.
ATV was one large academic exercise, says Kittu. We solved a problem that was not that important to many people. I'm not terribly proud of what we accomplished. We started out to change the world. Did we change the world? No fucking way.
There was another bad sign, though just how bad they didn't fully appreciate. Jim Clark was gone. He'd up and left the company he'd created and said he was going to start another.
It was good that Jim left, said Ed McCracken, in what must rank as one of the troughs in a career of understatement. No big company could accommodate such financial ambition.
Clark's lawyer had advised him to quit bitching and moaning about McCracken for 6 months and then walk into a board meeting and quit. And that's what he did. Publicly, he said he was leaving on the best of terms. Privately, he told friends that he was going to show fucking Ed McCracken that it was he, not McCracken, who had been responsible for the success of Silicon Graphics. He told the engineers who had helped him to create SGI that he was going to get rich. Rocky Rhodes recalls him stopping by to talk about his future plans.
Jim said right out, I'm going to make $100 million. And I said, that's great, Jim, and also something about how pleased I was with the way SGI had worked out. And then I said, but even if it hadn't worked out, I've had a great time, met great people, learned a lot. And Jim got mad. He said, no. If I go and do this next thing and don't make $100 million, it'll be a failure. I'll be a failure. And that's kind of the way I remember leaving it with him.
Pavan and Kittu knew most of this, and it troubled them, but not nearly as much as it should have. They still believed that economic history was moved along slowly by big companies like Silicon Graphics. By the time Clark walked out of SGI in early 1994, the list of grievances he was nursing had grown too long for anyone but him to keep track of. First, Glenn Mueller screws him. Then Ed McCracken takes full credit for things he was at best partially responsible for. Then Mueller and the other board members conspire to shut him out of the company, while McCracken fucks it up. Then Mueller and McCracken cut him out of the stock options pool. Then he puts the company right out in front of the future, arranges for Time Warner to pay for them to be there, and is then promptly shut out of all further discussion. The minute Time Warner's limousines turned up at Silicon Graphics, Ed McCracken had taken over the project. There was so much ill will between him and McCracken that when he found his image missing from a picture in the SGI annual report of the founding engineers, he assumed McCracken had ordered it removed. Success was his chosen form of revenge. Clark was intent on inventing a new role for himself that would not allow the Muellers and McCrackens to take advantage of him. In retrospect, there are many ways to describe this new role, but maybe the simplest is the way Clark described it to himself. The guy who finds the new thing and makes it happen wins. The engineers who help him do it finish second. The financiers and the corporate statesmen, the suckerfish of economic growth, finish a distant third. Clark intended to sit on top of Silicon Valley as surely as Microsoft sat on top of the personal computer. Of course, he was not the first engineer with a taste for money and power. He was just the one who finally said, "Now's the time to take it." But that version of events is misleadingly neat. Clark didn't conceptualize his new role. He groped for it. He had an animal desire to have what he wanted and not to have what he did not want. He wanted Silicon Valley to be even more suited than it already was to his talent for anarchy. He wanted to harness the forces of creation and destruction. He did not want to manage a large company. He did not even want to be a venture capitalist who vetted thousands of business plans, backed dozens of companies, and then sat back with Olympian detachment and hoped that a few became big. He wanted to create the company that invented the future. Once he'd done that, he wanted to do it again and again and again and again. For his services, he wanted to be treated better and paid more than anyone else. A few people sensed exactly how potent Clark was once he'd spun himself out of Silicon Graphics. The venture capitalist Dick Kramlich assigned a young man named Alex Slutsky, whom he had just hired out of the Harvard Business School, to follow Clark wherever he went.
"I told Alex to sleep under Jim's bed if he had to," recalls Kramlich. "Jim's a revolutionary, you know. He's out to revolutionize whatever needs to be revolted against."
Slutsky was a bit like one of those janitors at the Institute for Advanced Study who trailed around after the aged Albert Einstein and took down his random scribblings, on the off chance they turned out to be important. His job was to stick to Clark and take notes. When Clark finally decided on his next venture, Slutsky was to insist that Dick Kramlich at New Enterprise Associates be allowed to buy a piece of it.
"Dick was a little unusual in this view," says Slutsky. "Some of his partners didn't want to have anything to do with Jim Clark. They thought Jim Clark was a bit of a crazy guy."
But Slutsky did as he was told. After 4 years at Stanford and two at the Harvard Business School, he found himself dining with Clark two or three nights a week. Slutsky was small and mild-mannered and polite as a choir boy. He was unused to grown men flying into rages for no apparent reason. He listened to Clark rant about Ed McCracken, moan about Glenn Mueller, and think out his next move. At first, Clark believed the Orlando project might end well. He tried to buy the rights to the operating system from Time Warner and set himself up as the Microsoft of the new technology. Time Warner declined to sell. Next, Clark talked about creating new applications for the telecomputer. There was a lot that could be done with the device once a lot of people owned one. To do that, he needed young software talent, and to that end, called a 22-year-old not long out of the University of Illinois and new to the Valley named Mark Andreessen. Clark had seen a piece of software that Andreessen had helped to write in college called Mosaic. Mosaic enabled its user to travel around the Internet. Why anyone would wish to do so was, at the time, unclear. About the first thing Andreessen said was that he didn't want to make a business of Mosaic. Clark didn't care. His ambition was more inchoate than that. He needed to find some more software cowboys to replace the ones he'd left behind.
"I was desperate to find some smart engineers because I knew I wanted to start a company," he said. "And Mark knew a bunch of them from school."
For the next month or so, Alex Slutsky ate his dinners with Jim Clark and Mark Andreessen. Clark would spew ideas. Andreessen would jot them up in a business plan. Almost all of these ideas assumed the telecomputer under construction in Orlando, Florida, was the future. After all, Time Warner said it would spend $5 billion to make it happen. By that point, every big media and software company in the United States was intoxicated by the idea. Even if people weren't quite ready for the technology would be forced upon them. This wasn't the kitchen computer. Then one day, as Andreessen and Clark sat at Clark's kitchen table, Clark announced that he'd changed his mind. This wasn't unusual. Clark was always changing his mind. Now he said that his telecomputer was ahead of its time. It was too expensive to build.
"We could always build a Mosaic killer," said Andreessen.
"What do you mean?" said Clark.
Andreessen said that the software he'd written had been appropriated by the University of Illinois, but that he felt sure they'd bungle any subsequent attempt to commercialize it. He mentioned again that 25 million people were now using the World Wide Web and that their numbers had been doubling every year for a long time. Clark recalled,
"I thought, Jesus, those were big numbers. I've never been in a business with those kind of big numbers. Eventually, you were talking about all the people on Earth."
The whole time he'd been stewing with Andreessen about what to do, the solution was right in front of them, the Internet.
All of a sudden, it was clear to me when I looked at the Internet that I was looking at the personal computer in 1985, Clark said. It was this slow, clunky technology, but people were using it, and it would get faster. I realized that this was the thing I'd been groping for.
He and Andreessen hired Andreessen's college buddies who had written the code for Mosaic, which permitted a user to browse the Internet, and Clark had yet another team of young engineers to lead into battle. He called the company Mosaic Communications, then changed the name to Netscape. This time, Jim Clark was right. He was off and running down the dark tunnel with no end. Within 18 months, the world's biggest technology companies realized they'd been trumped. Bill Gates sent a memo to his employees saying that the Internet now posed the greatest threat to Microsoft's control of the computer industry. The 1,000 Microsoft employees dedicated to building a telecomputer were reassigned to compete with Jim Clark's startup. Thousands of others at Oracle and Sun and even Time Warner were similarly redirected.
"Jim put the whole of ITV out of business," says Pavan Nigam. "Everyone at once realized that the next big thing was not the television set, but the personal computer hooked up to the Internet."
If you page through his talk on the telecomputer, you can see just how chance favors the prepared mind. The presentation Clark made to his board back in 1992 is a fair blueprint for the Internet boom. All of the ideas, e-commerce, email, and some of the technology he dreamed up for his beloved telecomputer were grafted onto the Internet. You have to sit down and think for a bit to realize what that means, not just for Clark, but for anyone with the slightest interest in how economies and societies are nudged from one place to the next. A company dreamed up by a technical man a lot of big shots thought was slightly unhinged, with a 22-year-old who didn't want to do it in the first place, and another 22-year-old assigned to sleep under his bed, did not become merely a success. It torpedoed investments of hundreds of millions by the world's biggest corporations and putatively smartest minds. SGI, TW, Microsoft, Sun, Oracle, AT&T. Thousands of people had more or less wasted billions of dollars, and whether they knew it or not, they had been following his lead. Then, just as they all ran as a herd in one direction, he took off in another, and within 6 months, he made them all look like fools. It was one of the great unintentional head fakes in the history of technology. Soon enough, Clark's opinions reached the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road, who started calling and asking if they might invest in his company. Alex Slusky told Dick Kramlich that Clark was about to make his move, that he had invested $3 million of his own money, a substantial chunk of his total worth, into the venture. Kramlich called Clark, and Clark said that this time any venture capitalist who wished to back him would do so on new, unprecedentedly harsh terms. He was valuing the newly named Mosaic Communications, which consisted of $3 million of his money, and seven new graduates of the University of Illinois, at $18 million. He would permit venture capitalists to purchase a stake in the new company at three times what he had paid. Or, as he put it to Kramlich, "My dollars are worth three times what yours are worth." This was about three times what Kramlich expected to pay. Kramlich called John Doerr, who worked a few yards up Sand Hill Road, hoping that Doerr might help him to talk some reason into Clark. Instead, Doerr invited Clark to his office and gave him exactly what he asked for. His firm, Kleiner Perkins, purchased a 15% stake in Netscape, as the company eventually became known, that valued the company at $18 million, and left Clark still holding 25% of the company. "That moment," says Alex Slusky, "was the defining moment for this period in the Valley. No engineer had ever cut such a deal." Clark, who had grown fond of the young man assigned to sleep under his bed, offered Slusky a job at Netscape. Slusky turned it down. "He was just too volatile for me," he says. "I couldn't live like that." Dick Kramlich, who came up empty-handed, was upset. But the venture capitalist up on Sand Hill Road who called Clark most often, and who sounded the most upset, was Glenn Mueller. Throughout March 1994, Mueller called Clark repeatedly and pleaded to be let in on Netscape. He apologized for the way he treated Clark at Silicon Graphics. He said that he agreed with Clark. The Internet, not ITV, was the future. On April 4, 1994, the day Netscape was incorporated, Clark told Mueller for the last time that he would not be permitted to invest in Netscape. Mueller was calling from his sailboat off Cabo San Lucas. He pleaded with Clark one last time, and Clark rebuffed him. Soon after he got off the phone with Clark, Mueller picked up a gun and shot himself through the head. He died instantly. It took a while for the people who thought they knew Glenn Mueller to find an explanation that put their minds at rest. Mueller's wife let his colleagues know what they had not known, that he suffered from intense fear that people were out to destroy his business. In other words, he suffered from an extreme version of a mental disorder that many Silicon Valley tycoons prided themselves on, paranoia. The genealogy chart of Silicon Valley companies that decorated the walls of every office. Shockley spawned Fairchild. Fairchild spawned Intel. Intel spawned, and so on, was a cheery face on a violent truth. The new companies often put the old ones out of business. The young were forever eating the old. The whole of the Valley was a speeded-up edible drama. In this drama, technology played a very clear role. It was the murder weapon. For the next few weeks, until the tragedy passed from people's minds, a lot of people told Clark that Mueller's suicide wasn't his fault,
No human being killed himself simply because he was shut out of a business deal. They did this because in the back of their minds they suspected that maybe Mueller's suicide was Clark's fault. And so did Clark. 2,000 people turned out for Glenn Mueller's memorial service. Jim Clark read a poem he wrote for the occasion. Then he moved on, and maybe for the first time in his life, actually had to try to forget. It took a few years before Ed McCracken realized that he, too, would be excluded from the future Clark was inventing, but the process by which he was excluded began immediately. 6 months after he founded Netscape, Clark agitated for the company to go public. The company had few revenues, no profits, and a lot of new employees. No one else inside the company thought it should do anything but keep its head down and try to become a viable enterprise. "Jim was pressing for us to go public way before anyone else," recalls Mark Andreessen. It turned out there was a reason for this. He'd seen a boat called Juliet. He wanted one just like it, only bigger. To get it, he needed more money. By then, the decision was not Clark's alone to make. The company had hired a big-name CEO, Jim Barksdale, and had a proper board of directors. Barksdale didn't want to go public. He thought the company had enough problems trying to figure out how to turn a profit without having to explain itself to irate shareholders. But this time, Clark had power, through his equity stake. He called a meeting to discuss the IPO and stacked it with lawyers and bankers who stood to reap big fees from a public share offering, and who were, as a result, enthusiastic about his initiative. At that meeting, Barksdale finally capitulated. 18 months after Netscape was created, and before it had made a dime, Netscape sold shares in itself to the public. On the first day of trading, the price of those shares rose from $6 apiece to $24. 3 months later, it was at 70. It was one of the most successful share offerings in the history of the U.S. stock markets, and possibly the most famous. There was only one explanation for its success. The market now saw the future through Clark's eyes. "People started drinking my Kool-Aid," says Clark. "Netscape obviously didn't create the Internet, but if Netscape had not forced the issue on the Internet, it would have just burbled in the background. It would have remained this counterintuitive kind of thing. The criticism of it was that it was anarchy. What the IPO did was give anarchy credibility." In the frenzy that followed, a lot of the old rules of capitalism were suspended. For instance, it had long been a rule of thumb with the Silicon Valley venture capitalists that they didn't peddle a new technology company to the investing public until it had had at least 4 consecutive profitable quarters. Netscape had nothing to show investors but massive losses. But its fabulous stock market success created a precedent. No longer did you need to show profits. You needed to show rapid growth. Having a past actually counted against a company, for a past was a record, and a record was a sign of a company's limitations. Never mind that you weren't actually making money. There'd be time for that later, assuming someone eventually figured out how to make money from the Internet. For the moment, you needed to plow all of your revenues back into growth. You had to show that you were the company not of the present, but of the future. The most appealing companies became those in a state of pure possibility, which is to say that the U.S. capital markets acquired the personal predilections of Jim Clark. Another old rule that changed was the rule that the financiers who backed the company, and perhaps the CEO who steered it to success, made the most money and accumulated the most power. Anyone who bothered to read Netscape's prospectus discovered a curious fact. The venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road and the new CEO, Jim Barksdale, owned a few million shares each. In the end, they made hundreds of millions of dollars from Netscape and so had no reason to complain. But the young engineers whom Clark had pulled together to create the company also became rich. An engineer who joined Netscape in July 1995 was, by November, worth $10 million. Clark made certain that Mark Andreessen, the young inventor, did not suffer the same fate at the hands of the venture capitalists as he himself had 12 years before. After the IPO, Andreessen, who was 24, was worth $80 million. He also made certain that by far the biggest stake in the company, nearly one quarter of the whole, belonged to Jim Clark personally. Clark became the Valley's newest billionaire. The speed with which Clark had made himself and a lot of other engineers rich created new forces of greed and fear in Silicon Valley. Microsoft was 12 years old before people started talking about Microsoft millionaires. Netscape was 1.5. Up till then, the typical engineer's decision about where to work turned on old-fashioned considerations like salary and benefits, and the inherent technical interest of the work.
Suddenly, all of these were overshadowed by stock options. The engineers who went to work for Netscape were no different from you. And yet, they, not you, were getting rich. Worse, they were the B-team. The A-team of engineering had been, in general, too well treated by their companies to take a flyer on what appeared, from a distance, a doubtful new venture. Netscape ushered in an age of doubtful new ventures. Whether he liked it or not, every day he went to work, the engineer was making a huge financial gamble. Silicon Valley laid itself out before him like one giant high-stakes roulette table, and the engineer had to decide on which number he should place his services. Guess wrong, and he missed the boom. Guess right, and he'd be rich. Most people don't enjoy making huge gambles on the future. They would just as soon someone else tell them what to do, and that is what Jim Clark did. From the moment Netscape made him a billionaire, he acquired a new form of power, the power of being Jim Clark. Half the engineers in the Valley wanted to work for whatever company he started, on the assumption that if anyone was going to predict the future, it was Jim Clark. All Clark had to do was announce how he next planned to invent a future, and huge sums of money and vast reservoirs of engineering talent came pouring in, intent on proving him right. The question was, what would he do next? In late 1995, a lot of Silicon Graphics engineers were asking that question. The company had the smartest engineers, and the smartest among them had just wasted 2 years of their time and hundreds of millions of dollars. From the moment Netscape went public, Silicon Graphics was officially unwell, a company of the past rather than the future. The company stock peaked at $44 a share the week after the Netscape share offering, and then fell steadily for the next 4 years, right down to $8 a share. In 1997, Ed McCracken was fired from Silicon Graphics. He left Silicon Valley and took a job running a foundation in upstate New York. Many of the people who thought him a genius just a few years earlier now thought him a fool.
"At the time, I thought Jim was just brutal with Ed," says Dick Kramlich, who negotiated McCracken's golden handshake. "Now, I think Jim was just right."
A lot of the engineers at Silicon Graphics promised themselves that whatever Jim Clark did next, they would do it with him. Word spread that Clark was off building a new boat. A boat. His boat is where he always went when he was stewing on the new thing. His old friend Forrest Baskett, who had followed Clark from Stanford to Silicon Graphics, received a phone call from Clark. It was late 1995, just after Netscape went public, and Clark became the Valley's newest billionaire. Yet Clark did not sound satisfied. He sounded agitated, the way he did when something came between him and what he wanted. He wanted to talk to Forrest about his new boat. As it happened, Forrest had introduced Clark to sailing in the San Francisco Bay. Now, just a few years later, Clark was trying to figure out whether the boat he wanted to build could fit into the San Francisco Bay.
"Forrest,"
he asked,
"how high is the Golden Gate Bridge?"
Chapter 6. The Boom and the Mast. Once a month, sometimes more often, Clark would crawl out of bed at 4 in the morning, drive down to the private air terminal in San Jose, California, climb aboard his new jet, and fly to Amsterdam. The plane couldn't make it without refueling. At some point, he had discovered a strip of tundra north of the Arctic Circle with a tiny village that consisted of not much more than a tarmac, a gas pump, and an emergency medical station for Eskimos. He'd dive down out of the sky, pull up next to the pump, pull out his American Express card, buy 2,000 gallons of gasoline from an Eskimo, and shove off. Once he arrived in Amsterdam, he'd drive an hour and a half north to Walter Hausmann's boatyard in Vollenhove. Vollenhove felt only slightly less remote than the Eskimo town. Clark made this trip 38 times between the Netscape public offering in August 1995 and the launching of the boat that the Netscape public offering had paid for in December 1998. One of those times came in late January 1998, 5 months before Hyperion was scheduled to be finished, and 11 months before it actually would be finished. The boat perched like a beached white whale on a dolly in the hangar beside Walter Hausmann's office. There was, as usual on these visits by Clark, the tingle in the air that precedes bad news. Inside the office, Clark settled in at a conference table across from Walter Hausmann, several of Walter's underlings, and the captain of Hyperion, Alan Pryor, and waited to hear what that news might be. Replicas of wooden boats and sepia-toned photographs of Walter's ancestors surrounded the table. It was a working office, but also a shrine to the Hausmann sailing tradition, a tradition that Clark now threatened.
A bookmaker not intimately familiar with the characters would probably say that the odds were against the challenger. Traditions are more easily preserved where the risks of changing things outweigh the rewards, and sailboat building is one such place. A sailboat built by Walter in 1992 had a great deal in common with a sailboat built by Walter in 1972, or a sailboat built by Walter's father in 1932, or a sailboat built by Walter's grandfather in 1892, for the very simple reason that the houseman way of doing things had kept a lot of people dry. For better than 100 years now, the Royal Houseman Shipyard had churned out lovely wooden boats not so very different from the original Dutch pleasure craft of the 17th century. Normally, the glorious Dutch boat-building tradition was what Walter was selling. When a rich man turned up in the Royal Houseman Shipyard, among the first things he was shown were the charming old black-and-white photographs of the 13-year-old Walter building a dinghy with his father. The rich man was allowed to finger the lovely old wooden models of yachts built long ago, and to hear about the fires and the floods and the various occupying German armies that the Houseman Shipyard had survived. Then, in 1993, the odds shifted dramatically, when a new kind of sailboat customer showed up. He was American, an entrepreneur from San Francisco. He wanted a yacht bigger than any houseman had ever built, 142 feet. To make certain he got exactly what he wanted, he made dozens of trips to the remote northern Dutch village of Vollenhoven. Occasionally, he slept on the floor of Walter Houseman's office. He was, in the way that the English disapprove of, aggressive. In late 1993, the boat was finished. It was christened Juliet. Juliet marked a shift in the demand curve, at least in Walter's newly unsettled mind. His business, which had been 60% German, became 75% American. The rich, and especially the new American rich, suddenly acquired a taste for obscenely big boats, and the high technology required to run them. The boats have ceased to be merely boats. They were tiny, floating city-states. Walter kept his objections to his customers' tastes to himself, at least until they were out of shouting range. But after they left, he'd explode.
"Always bigger, bigger, bigger," he'd shout. "If someone has the 90-foot boat, they want a 95-foot boat. If someone else has the 95-foot sailboat, they want a 100-foot sailboat. It is normal, yeah?"
He left it open whether he was making a simple statement or asking a question. Either way, Walter was not entirely at ease in the new climate. Before Juliet, the official slogan of the Royal Houseman Shipyard had been, "If you can dream it, we can build it." Now, a new sign hung in one of Walter Houseman's offices. "Their dream is our nightmare." At his most pessimistic, Walter could have had no idea what strange forces Juliet would unleash. When she left the Houseman Shipyard, she made her way back to San Francisco Bay, where she was seen and admired by technically minded people poised to create one of the loudest explosions of wealth in economic history. In the summer of 1995, the first of these people walked into Walter's office at the Houseman Shipyard. He said his name was Jim Clark, and he had just created a new internet company called Netscape. To buy the yacht of his dreams, he explained, he had persuaded his board of directors to take Netscape public, that is, sell shares in the enterprise to investors. He often did the right things for the wrong reasons. Walter called around to find out whether Clark's money was real, and he came up empty. No one he knew had ever heard of Netscape. It turned out the company had existed for a bit more than a year, had made huge losses, and had no concrete plans to make profits, and, well, Walter couldn't begin to say what it actually did. Then, a few months later, Walter found himself reading magazine articles about Jim Clark. Netscape had made Clark a billionaire. Walter's role in the creation of Clark's computerized yacht had been to suffer ironically. It was a role to which he was poorly suited. Clark and his new ideas were actually very stressful to Walter. He'd spent 2.5 years with this contradiction squarely in the middle of his life. A customer who wanted to grope for the new thing in his old place. Walter woke up in the middle of the night imagining the headlines in the newspapers. "World-famous houseman yacht sinks. Houseman owner unable to explain computer boat." He'd aged visibly. A few months into the work on Hyperion, his heart went bad and he was taken away to a hospital bed. After a few days, he emerged with a doctor's order to take it easy, and found Jim Clark and his computer programmers waiting for him in his boatyard. On this particular visit of Clark's, Walter opened the conversation with one of his pet themes, the wisdom of letting a computer sail the boat. A recent article in one of the yachting magazines pointed out that Jim Clark's new sailboat would learn to sail itself in all conditions. Hyperion was, in fact, a learning machine.
It contained thousands of electronic sensors capable of measuring everything from the pressure on the sails to the temperature in the fridges. They would feed a continuous stream of data into 24 industrial-strength computers. Over time, the computers would acquire the information they needed to cope with every possible sailing condition. If he wished, Clark could connect to Hyperion over the Internet from his living room back in California, seize the computer from the captain, and sail it from a keyboard. That particular point had caught Walter Hausman's eye.
"I don't believe in that," he said brusquely. "You need a captain on board, yeah?"
"I don't believe in it either," said Clark.
In the past year, perhaps as a concession to Walter's weak heart, Clark had taken to claiming that never in a million years would he try to sail his boat from his computer back in California.
"But," he continued, "it's a nice thing to have cruise control on a car, you have to admit. You may or may not use it, but it's a nice thing to have."
Walter thought about that for a second or two, as if deciding whether Clark had conceded his point. He concluded that he had.
"The boat is just another thing for him to write software for," he said to the others with a great big laugh.
"Well," said Clark, pressing, "you wouldn't want to do any accidental jobs in a boat this big."
This was an understatement. Clark was building the world's tallest mast. The world's tallest mast supported the world's largest sail. The world's largest sail implied the greatest wind ever collected in one place. By eliminating the problem of handling the sails manually, the computer had made this ambition feasible.
"Yeah," said Walter, "this is true."
"And you wouldn't mind having the boat set off an alarm to warn you when you are sailing dangerously close to the wind," said Clark, running down his mental list of the many feats the computer might perform better than a fallible human being.
"Yeah," said Walter, less happily, "this is also true."
The yachting magazine had also pointed out that Hyperion would have not only a brain, but also a voice. Rather than sound an alarm, the computer would actually holler at the captain. If the captain ignored the warning, the computer would shout at him again.
"Watch out, you bloody fool,"
was Clark's suggestion for a second warning sound.
"Yes," said Captain Alan Pryor uneasily. "I heard there would be a voice."
"A millennium voice," grumbled Walter.
Walter was not entirely comfortable with the idea of a talking boat.
"A German voice," said Clark, laughing at the idea of it.
He put on his best Third Reich accent and boomed,
"Alan, the boat is sinking. Get out of your bunk."
Clark enjoyed the joke more than Walter, and Walter enjoyed the joke more than Alan. But then Alan had heard why Clark had decided to computerize a sailboat in the first place. This particular brainwave washed over Clark back in 1991, when, in despair over what was happening at Silicon Graphics, he had retired to the high seas to stew on the telecomputer. No matter where he turned, however, he had trouble with his captains. The captain of the boat Clark then owned had sailed one evening from St. Bart's to Anguilla. On the way back, he'd run the boat quietly up onto a coral reef. Just as quietly, he'd slipped the boat off of it. He never told Clark, who spent that night ashore, of the mishap. But Clark's wife, Nancy Rutter, who had been aboard, had been partially awakened by the sound of the scraping. That his captain kept this piece of data from him 5 years before infuriated Clark to this day. From this, he drew the lesson. The captain needs to be watched. And from this, he had the idea. Write a computer program to watch him. A computer could monitor everything that happened on board the boat. All Clark would need to do was keep an eye on his screen, and he'd know most of what his captain got up to when he was away. Alan Pryor knew the story, and so he also knew that the computer software was aimed at him. Putting the computer to one side, Walter then finally broke the bad news.
"Jim," said Walter, "this boat they are building in New Zealand, it will have a mast that is maybe bigger than yours."
Clark leaned back in his chair.
"Maybe more than 200, said Walter.
"More than 200 feet? Asked Clark.
Walter nodded.
"And we're only 197, said Alan.
Sometimes they said it was 189 feet, other times 197. Whatever. It was big. 197 feet was an important number in Clark's mind. 197 feet was the maximum height for any boat that wished to pass at high tide beneath the Balboa Bridge in the Panama Canal. Clark assumed that any boat big enough to support a 197-foot mast would want to be able to pass through the Panama Canal. If he was right, his 197-foot mast would be not merely the tallest built to date, but the tallest built for all time.
"How tall exactly is this other mast we are dealing with here?" said Clark.
But before they could answer, he was up and pacing. I take that back. He wasn't actually standing and walking around. I call it pacing because I can think of no other way to get across the effect he had on everyone else in the room. In fact, he merely altered his facial expressions. His mouth squinched up into its tiny pucker, his face reddened slightly, and his head bobbed like a boxer's between punches. But to judge from the faces across the table from him, he might as well have risen from his chair and marched back and forth across Walter's office while hollering at the top of his lungs. Walter looked stricken. Soon enough, Clark actually was on his feet and leading the others out of Walter Hausman's office. They left the back way and crossed the catwalk that snaked around Hyperion, four stories off the ground. At that point, Hyperion was a skeleton of its future self, and you could see all of its baffling complexity. There were 12 refrigerators, a water maker, a sewage treatment plant, 3 generators, an engine the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, an endless number of hydraulic-powered winches, and several thousand electronic sensors affixed to everything that could be measured by a computer. There were 60 miles of electrical wires running from the sensors to 24 Silicon Graphics computers, which stored and manipulated the data. They collected and analyzed 40,000 separate pieces of information. The boat had been reduced to the sum of its digital data. Clark and Walter and Allen and the Royal Hausman executives walked past all this marvelous complexity down the steps of the catwalk and through a shop floor teeming with the 50 woodworkers crafting the boat's teak and mahogany furnishings. These people were as different from Clark as Maori tribesmen. Many of them had learned their craft in the Hausman shipyard from their fathers, who in turn learned their craft in the Hausman shipyard from their fathers. Generations of Dutch boat builders lived and died without giving a passing thought to leaving. There was never a question when they got out of bed in the morning what they would do that day or the next or the next. They were the tiny figures in the middle ground of the Dutch landscape, content to leave the world as they had found it. The group of executives, led by Clark, entered the shed at the end of the yard. Before Clark arrived on the scene, there was no building in the Hausman shipyard that could house a 197-foot mast. Clark had waved that objection to one side and said he would pay for a new building. The new building in the old boatyard was long and low and light. From a distance, it appeared to be an enormous greenhouse. It wasn't. It was an oven. Once finished, and well before it impaled the boat, the mast would acquire its slick white veneer, but now it was a long black rod stretched out across the floor. No one who didn't know what it was would ever guess. It could be, perhaps, the Alaska pipeline. When finished, tilted upright and sealed onto the boat, it would fail to fit beneath the Sydney Harbor Bridge, the Coronado Bridge in San Diego, or the Triborough Bridge in New York City. Even now, a dozen workers were gradually thickening its girth by wrapping layer upon thin layer of black carbon fiber. After they laid each layer, the workers heated the building to the material's melting point. The black layers melded together into a blacker hole. Blacker and blacker the mast grew. It wasn't built. It was cooked. And until 10 minutes ago, it was the world's tallest mast. That this might no longer be true distressed Clark. Of course, he knew as well as anyone how ridiculous it was for him to make a big deal about having the world's largest mast. That was one of many odd things about him. One minute he could say, "Who cares which rich guy has the tallest mast?" and actually believe every word of it. The next minute he would be standing at one end of the shed with his arms outreached as if he was Moses parting the Red Sea, and the mast jutting out from him like an enormous black phallus and booming, "Mine's 60 meters. How long's yours?" Inside him, a quality and a chemical, intelligence and testosterone, wrestled for hegemony. At the moment, the chemical was winning on points. The chemical gave rise to a certain unease in him. Journalists were forever describing Clark as a tall, lanky Texan. The picture this conjured up of a big, easygoing fellow loping through town with a sloppy grin on his face was completely false. He was big, and he could fake a certain relaxed quality for just long enough to fool a stranger, but there was nothing easygoing about him. His temperament did not belong in a man of his size. He was as agitated as a mongoose eyeing a cobra. This agitation could be deeply unsettling to others. Rich Carlgaard, the publisher of Forbes, and a longtime observer of Silicon Valley, once said that there were only 3 men in the Valley who were physically intimidating. Larry Ellison, who ran Oracle, Gerald Saunders, who ran Advanced Micro Devices, and Clark, who ran himself. That statement was both strange and true. It was strange because though Clark had a temper, he was never violent. It was true because people often were terrified of Clark, even if they didn't fear being hit. Clark let his anger rage freely inside of him. Once it had reached a boiling point, he choked it off. The object of his anger looked into Clark's face and saw a blast furnace that was about to blow up. Hence, the pucker. In any case, on that morning in the Houseman shipyard, Clark did not have to say why he was a bit upset because everyone in the shed knew why he was a bit upset. He had gone to some trouble to determine the rules for boats that wished to pass beneath the Balboa Bridge in the Panama Canal. Now Walter tells him that he missed a trick. At low tide, and with special permission from the U.S. government, which owned and administered the Panama Canal, boats that rose 200 feet over the water were allowed to sail through. Worse, in the year 2000, the Panamanian government gained control of the canal from the U.S. government. And the Panamanian government was now saying that it might extend the height limit from 200 feet to 204 feet. The owner of the New Zealand boat, an Atlanta real estate man, figured he could suffer the inconvenience of waiting until low tide to pass through the canal for a year. After the canal became Panamanian in 2000, he could pass through any time he pleased. Standing on one end of what was now clearly only temporarily the world's longest mast, Clark thought about his own private Y2K problem. He asked Walter what he thought about adding an extension to the mast. Walter muttered that he did not think it was a good idea. Finally, Clark turned to Allen, his captain, and said,
"I think we should challenge this Atlanta guy to a sailboat race."
Clark's life always had a topsy-turvy quality. But from the moment Netscape went public and he became Silicon Valley's newest billionaire, it became more reversed than ever. His play took on the intensity of work, and his work acquired the flavor of play. His play was his creation of the world's first computerized yacht, and the yacht, more than anything else, kept him up all hours. Many nights he lay awake thinking up mathematical solutions to Hyperion software problems. For instance, one problem that irked him was how to create a gauge on a computer screen that had the look of a mechanical gauge. Mimicking reality inside a computer was his career-long obsession. His PhD thesis at the University of Utah had been about virtual reality. One day he created a fuel gauge in the normal fashion, using the new computer language C++. That night he lay awake torturing himself over the sloppiness of the work. He disliked the imprecision of computer language, which he thought of as an inexact science. He became more and more irritated that the gauge did not look exactly like a mechanical gauge. There was no shading around the edges, for instance, and the needle clicked along like a digital tool, rather than smoothly gliding along like the analog speedometer on a car. At 3 a.m, he finally gave up trying to sleep. He slipped out of bed without waking his wife, got in his car, and drove to his office 3 miles down the road. The problem was the fucking computer language. One of the reasons the software business favored the young is that every so often the language changed. It was as if you announced to the population of France that they would be speaking not French, but Esperanto. Old people with their old language were shoved aside by new people who, with nothing invested in the old language, picked up the new language more easily. That Clark, in the late 1980s, had bothered to teach himself C++ was itself a triumph of character over condition. In the Valley, anyone over 40 tended to fade into technical irrelevance.
"I'm an old dog who taught himself a new trick," Clark would say.
He was an old dog who taught himself so many new tricks that he was a threat to the reputation of old dogs. This particular trick did not exactly do the trick. And so there, at 3 a.m, in his dingy little office over the Jenny Craig Weight Loss Center, Clark solved his problem with mathematics, then translated the solution back into computer code. When he was finished, he had a gauge he liked. The truth was that no casual observer could say when Clark was working and when he was playing. In part, this was because, to Clark's way of thinking, the big distinction wasn't between work and play, but between creating new technology for money and creating new technology for pleasure. In part, it was because there was no distinction at all. By the fall of 1995, Clark had finished with Netscape. Having learned from Silicon Graphics that he did not really belong inside a large organization, he designed all future large organizations without a place for himself inside. He kept the title of chairman and sat on the Netscape board and held on to most of his 19 million or so shares. The stock had split. But really, he didn't do much but attend a few meetings and trouble the company's new chief executive, Jim Barksdale, with his various premonitions of what was about to happen. To Clark, it seemed clear that the Internet browser business would one day be devoured by Microsoft. Microsoft had devoured SGI slowly. It would devour Netscape quickly. Microsoft's monopoly in the PC operating system gave it 2 big advantages in the battle for the Internet. The first was billions of dollars in profits.
it could outspend any rival. The second was leverage over every company that intended to sell anything to the user of the PC. Netscape already was at Microsoft's mercy. There was no point in designing newer and better versions of its internet browser that were not compatible with each subsequent version of Microsoft Windows, and it could not do this without receiving early versions of Windows from Microsoft. Microsoft had done a good job marketing itself as a dynamic young company intent on changing the world, and to many people, that is what it was. To Clark, it was a force for slowing change, so that change did not disrupt its monopoly. It was bigger than General Motors and, in its way, just as stodgy. And so Jim Clark set out thinking about how to make himself another $1 billion, to replace the billion he might lose to Bill Gates. That was the starting point for Clark after Netscape. How to make not millions, but billions of dollars, quickly. When he cooked up his plans, it never occurred to him that he was an outsider with no experience in the industry he planned to invade. He felt that pretty much the entire American economy was up for grabs, thanks to the Internet. No, the problem was that any computer-related market that was big enough to enable Clark to become much richer than he already was would be a market Microsoft itself would covet. When he asked himself, "How do I make another $1 billion for myself?" he was really asking, "How do I make another $1 billion for myself before Microsoft notices what I'm up to?" It took him 4 months to come up with an answer. In late 1995, Clark was diagnosed with a rare blood disease, hemochromatosis. Essentially, his blood produced more iron than his body needed. The disease required Clark to visit the hospital once every few weeks, where he was subjected to the old medieval panacea, bleeding. It was the first time he'd visited a hospital since he'd crashed his motorcycle and shattered his leg. The blizzard of forms and the bureaucracy was more than any new billionaire could be expected to tolerate. It got him thinking of a solution. By early 1996, Americans were spending $1.5 trillion a year on their health care, and about a third of that was pure waste. Much of the waste could be avoided simply by eliminating the paperwork. Since much of the paperwork seemed designed to prevent the patient from getting what he wanted when he wanted it, eliminating it would please the customer. The Internet was made for such tasks. In effect, the Internet enabled all of the many parties of any healthcare transaction to be present in the same room. The patient could walk into the office of a doctor he'd never met, supply the doctor with a password, and a few seconds later, the doctor would have his medical record and insurance coverage. A few minutes after the patient had left, the doctor would bill the insurer over the Internet and be paid by the insured over the Internet. If the patient needed drugs, those too could be ordered from the screen, right in the doctor's office. No forms, no papers, no hassle. Clark sat down with a piece of paper, and drew a little diagram. It contained the words, payers, doctors,